So one of the things I realized that I didn't finish, and it's going to get to some of the questions that got asked right before break, was this chart right up here. So I got down to the biological component part, but then I did not talk about the life component part. And remember, like personality, we're a combination of biological and then life experiences. And so one of the things that I wanted to talk about is that green layer up there, and I apologize for the coloring of this. It makes it light and sometimes you can't see it. But that green area up there says trauma, parental, psychopathological, or failure, psychopathology in the parents, something wrong with the parents, or loss and or rejection as a child. And so a couple questions I want to talk about here, a couple things. So when you're dealing with young ladies struggling with borderline personality disorder, you're often going to get stories of trauma and abuse. They're going to be very, very common. The big debate in the field was how much of that trauma is imagined and how much of that is real. And I'm not going to talk a lot about that today, but that is a question that is out there that remains that I'm not going to, for various reasons about what we're doing today, I'm not going to get into deeply. But the other piece that I want to talk about, and so there is a lot of trauma or perceived or actual trauma that these folks experience, and many people that struggle with borderline personality disorder have experienced complex trauma, that is little traumas over an extended period of time that has helped shape this personality. And then you see, as you can see, you have that biological underpinning, and then you have that trauma, that parental struggle, abuse you can put in there, all kinds of other things that you can put in there. And then what happens is you get this emotional volatility and also this impulsive acting out and the other chronic symptoms. The question becomes, when do you address the trauma? And so I want to get back to that piece. This is going to be somewhat controversial. The order in which you address that. Some people believe that you must address the trauma off the top. That is not where I fall on this. Because if you try to address the trauma without addressing some of the emotional stuff first, you're going to lose the person and you're going to get lost. Because of the interference of their emotional expression, it actually makes getting to the trauma and addressing the trauma very difficult. Once some of those emotions have calmed down, then you can get to the trauma. And the other people say, how in the world do you expect the person to have those emotions calmed down if the trauma is still present? It is possible. Because you have to make this decision about how much of the healing. So one of the things that I work really hard before I even get to the person's story sometime is to deal with those emotional response that they have with me and I have with them. Because if I don't get through their emotional response to me and the threat that I represent to them and the threat they represent to me, if I can't get through that and a trust can't develop, we can't really do good trauma work. And so I have to work in establishing that trust. So one of the things, the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to battle for trust. I'm going to battle for trust. And I'm going to leave the trauma for later. Sometimes you're going to reach a young lady who has very, very high walls of protection. And if you try to do work until those high walls are down, you're not going to get very far. And the other thing that I don't want to underplay is the healing power of taking those walls down. You don't need to hear the person's story to take those walls down. Because a lot of times that person's story is going to become important once the walls are down. So there's a lot of times that I work with young ladies that I don't know much about their story for months into their walk with me. We're going to go around and around and around the walls until I get inside. And it could take months sometimes. But there's nothing like those walls beginning to crumble and you know that you're getting in. And then that trust develops. Then you have a place and a time to hear the trauma. And then you can begin to work on the trauma. But for me, until I deal with that lack of trust that's there and the what I call relationship pain that makes relationships difficult, it's not going to work to do trauma work. There are people who disagree with me and do the other approach. I understand their approach. I just don't find it as helpful for me to do that, to go for trauma first and then do relationship stuff. Because that relationship stuff and the stuff, the anger, the lack of trust is so difficult, and it so much interferes with one's ability to work on trauma. Okay, hopefully that's clearer. The medication question. How does medication question fit in? Here's the confusing part. Individuals who struggle with borderline personality disorder are the most likely to be diagnosed medication-wise. They get more medications prescribed to them than any other disorder that's out there. Number two, every single medical agency says there are no medications that address borderline personality disorder. Right? That's the dilemma that you face with borderline personality disorder. Sometimes one of the first warning signs for me that somebody may have borderline personality disorder is when they come in and they have multiple medications throughout their history. And I look and I think, oh, wow, you've been on 17 different medications. Now, that's not to say that you can't treat some of the depression that comes along with borderline personality disorder with SSRIs, mood stabilizers, Lamictal and all of those, Tegretol, Depakote, can impact aggression and impulsivity. Sometimes antipsychotics are used, but I will say this, they are not going to address the core symptoms of borderline personality disorder. They're going to be supplements, they're not going to be the core. I think that's all I want to say about medications. That's enough for that. Joel can talk more about medications tomorrow. So once I have built trust, then I'm going to try to do skill training. Once I've done some skill training, then I'm going to start to work on trauma if trauma is present. And again, somebody asked the question. Let me circle back to a couple other questions as well. Somebody asked how often is trauma present for people that struggle with borderline personality disorder. Again, perceived or actual trauma is probably in the 90% of people who struggle with borderline personality disorder. How many people actually have borderline personality disorder? That's a pretty small percentage. It's somewhere around 1% of the population. Of people who have it 1 to 3% someplace. Actually, I was thinking about this. It's actually pretty close to OCD. The other thing I'll add here while I'm just throwing out disclaimers. Stories I tell, I twist enough that hopefully you don't know who they are. But I hope Joshua said something about that yesterday as well. I try to make that the case. One of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is talking about how do you have relationships? How do you have relationships? Because that is such a difficult thing to have. How do you learn to trust people? But what I spend a lot of time doing is spending a lot of times walking with when that feeling of abandonment, when you begin to fear that this person is about to abandon me, how do you not punch them in the face? How do you live with that tension that's building up inside of you that says I need to punch them before they punch me? How do I live with that? Because that fear is so intense and that desire to punch them is so strong that creates conflict. And so how do we manage that fear of abandonment? I have the God question down here. This is the piece that's hard for me. That fear of abandonment by God is just as strong often as the fear of abandonment by people. they struggle with God the way they struggle with other people. They get angry with God just like they get angry with other people. They go on strike with God just like they do with other people. They can go without reading their devotions, cracking a Bible, and then you try to have Bible study with them. They can spit that back at you. Depends on how well-behaved they are. They can be very calm about that spitting, or they can spit pretty vigorously in your face about that. But that doesn't mean that they don't care about God. It means that you're getting their anger and their fear of abandonment or their thought that God has let them down. This is where I've learned to listen to a lot of hostility about God without feeling the need to defend God in that situation. I'm going to try to drain that venom before I begin to bring God in back in the picture in a different way. I wish, you know, for many of us, it's so easy to just say, well, the Lord will never leave you or forsake you. Right? It's a beautiful verse. It's true. But they're not going to believe you when you say that. Or they're going to say, well, that works for everybody else but me. God has something in against me personally, or God doesn't like me, or he uses me as his punching bag, or all of those things we're going to hear. So learning relational skills. How do I not strike out at other people when I mistrust them? How do I develop more trust in them? Is that easy to do? It is not. It is not easy to do. Number two, emotional management. How do you deal with rage inside of you and express that rage in a way that doesn't burn other people and burn yourself? That's just hard to do. I don't know. I feel bad just leaving that kind of dump there, but that is a very, very difficult piece. The other piece is, what do you do with suicidal behavior and self-harm behavior? Because that has to be addressed. But how do you do that? What's the method of doing that? Because how do we take suicide off the table? One of the things that I will talk about is when suicide is on the table, I am interacting with you with a gun on the table with us. And it's hard to feel relaxed when there's a gun on the table between the two of us, and I know you can grab it at any time. So can we at least put suicidality on the chair for now? You can at least grab it, but at least I don't have to see it. And so that we can begin to move the suicide gun further and further away so that it becomes a way to relate between the two of us without that protection. Because it is a protection. It's a source of protection. It's a relational protection for them that says when things get too intense, I can go to this method of relational management. It's a dangerous thing to do, but you have to figure out in the emotional management piece, how do I manage that piece? Distress tolerance is talked about a lot right now, so I'm not going to speak. Well, I should speak a little bit about it. I can't just assume that everybody knows. Distress tolerance is how do I live with emotions inside of me without the need to express them? Every time we have an emotion, doesn't need we need to express it. That's different than stuffing, you all. Stuffing is when I just pretend I don't have a feeling. But emotion is when I acknowledge my feeling and I say, yes, I am very angry right now, but I'm going to choose not to express it in this moment, or I'm going to choose it in this way. So distress tolerance is finding ways to distract yourself from the pain, finding ways to change your expectations, your thoughts, and all of that stuff that fits into counseling and other ways. But to figure out ways where you can find some relief from the intensity of the emotions that you're experiencing. The other thing I'll add before we switch topics here. You do need to pace yourself so that you're not just one of the multiple people that they feel like they burned through and burned up and then they moved on. Because that's going to have happened to them, and they're going to have experienced that. So in some ways you're going to have to know how you can handle the intensity of it. And again, this sounds so bad, and I don't mean it to sound bad for those that are experiencing it because it is so hard. But I often talk about that I need to put on my protective gear in that relationship, which again, not because they're awful, horrible people, because I am going to work really hard to love them as they need to be loved. But sometimes you need to do that behind protective gear. And so figure out the ways that you can do that. Now, that may mean you limit the number of phone calls you take from them, how many times they call, how long they call. I generally try to have phone calls that don't last any longer than 10 minutes. Now, that's my goal. Does that happen very often? I work really hard to make it happen. The story I tell over and over again, life is playing on the field. If we have timeouts all the time and we're over here in the puddle, the other team is scoring goals on us all the time while we're in the timeouts. We can't be in timeouts all the time. I know that it feels good to be in timeouts, but the other team is winning. Don't we want to win? Now, it's bad when they don't, but so limit those phone calls and figure out how to do it. When you live with them, though, and when you minister with them in real life, it's a lot harder to do than when you're a counselor and you have a lot more protection. It's for sure true. Okay. Any last questions about borderline personality disorder? Yes, Julia. Yes. So the question is, so borderline develops when you're younger, and does it look different when as they get older? It does. It becomes less intense. The flame is not quite as high, and it becomes a little more calmer in its reflection. The bitterness is a little less direct and a little less expressed. The rule of thumb is that without any intervention at all, it tends to disappear in the 60s. The 50s and 60s. So, can you count on that? It's a long time. But again, it just looks different in grandmothers. Okay, let's switch to narcissistic personality disorder. Let's do the technical piece. Five or more of these again. Number one, has a grandiose sense of self-importance, exaggerates achievements, expectations to be recognized as superior without actually competing for these achievements. This is done through overestimating their capabilities. Again, I'm going to argue that Anabaptist culture really reshapes narcissism because of how strongly we teach against pride. It is much more subtle and it's much more underground, except for really, really difficult cases, really, really strong cases, because it gets reshaped by the strong teaching in Anabaptist culture against pride. Now, that's changing as time goes on. But again, growing up, I remember just that drivenness about not being prideful, even to not tell your children that you love them over fear that that will produce pride in them or too much praise. So some of this is going to look a little muted in Anabaptist culture because of that strong teaching. The sense of superiority that they have and bragging to exaggerate their achievements. And again, it has to be done a little more tricky in Anabaptist circles because of who we are. Number two, a preoccupation with fantasies of success, power, brilliance, beauty, and perfect love. These folks, when left alone in their own mind, will have lots of fantasies about how amazing they are, just amazing. Everything they do is amazing. I don't want to get into politics, but I often think about this when I listen to Donald Trump speak. Everything he does is a perfect, beautiful. You listen to that man speak, and it is everything is just like boom, boom, boom. And I listen to that, and I think, people, he doesn't really mean that, but people take it both ways. But everything is the absolute most beautiful phone call I've ever had. Not one thing was wrong in that phone call. And he'll do that over and over and over and over again. enough said. I'm not going to say any more about that topic. They believe that they are special and can't be understood by or should only be associated with special people. This is an interesting one too, particularly in the ministry when you become a minister. Is this growing sense that only other ministers and only special ministers can understand me? And again, that becomes this kind of unique thing that makes this feeling of specialness, and that I am unique and it can only be understood by a few. Which also then makes it very hard for other people to speak into their lives. Because it's only those special people that have the ability to speak into that person's life. The rest of the losers can't, and I say that loosely because we're not losers, but the rest of us who don't meet that don't have that ability to do that. Number four, requires excess admiration. These folks are in need of constant praise and attention. They fish for compliments. And again, in the Anabaptist culture, you have to do that a little more sophisticatedly because we don't give a lot of compliments. But they are going to fish for them in very interesting ways in order to get them. The other thing that you have to remember, if other people don't give them the admiration and the praise that they desire, they become very angry. And that anger can turn on you when you do not get that. The thing to remember is, the theory is, that behind that, for many of them, is a fragile sense of self. And self-criticism is taken very personally. Any criticism that other people give them, it feels like hatred. It feels so much stronger than the person means it. So, therefore, Ephesians 4:15, to speak the truth in love, for these men, they often don't feel it as love, but they feel it as hatred. So, therefore, criticism becomes, my family, they hate me. The ministry hates me. Other people hate me. Now, again, depending on how sophisticated they are, they're going to hide that hatred and that anger, at least from people outside the family. But within the family, you're going to get a lot more of that anger. Number five, a sense of entitlement, such as unreasonable expectations of favorable treatment or compliance with his or her expectations. This compliance with expectations comes through both in ministry and in families, but particularly families. That their wife or their children have to cater to them in almost every way, or they become extremely angry. They believe that they are better than other people and they deserve special treatment, particularly from family members. Just a word to put in here. They often prefer their children over their spouse. They often prefer their children over their spouse, particularly one child. There's usually one child that they really identify with, the one who looks or acts the most like them or is most aligned with them. The reason we think that they prefer one child over their wife is because their child is an extension of them. And so it's kind of a form of self-love by loving that one child particularly. My best friend, who I mentioned earlier, really struggled with this with his own father when his father was living, because he was not that child that got picked by his father. And that sense of what it's like to see that child get heaped with all kinds of praise and admiration. I will never forget when I met my friend when we were 18. He told me one time when we were talking, he said, "Yeah, my dad often says it's not fun to be a chief when there's no Indians." At the time, I didn't even know what that would mean. But after a while, I figured out, oh yeah, for him, the glory of being dad is being able to direct and be able to be that chief. And when there's no Indians to be the chief to have a job, there's no part of life. Life becomes boring. Number six, is exploitive, takes advantage of others to achieve their own mean. This is usually done unconsciously, sometimes very consciously, but they form friendships and relationships as a way of boosting who they are. They value success over other people's needs. People become something to use to achieve what you want. They justify taking advantage of other people or being cruel to them when they're not getting their own way. The thing that's often hard is they have a shifting sense of morality. Their morality is continually shifting to best benefit them. Their ability to lie, how do you talk about this one? They would not say that they're lying. They would say that number one, they become really skilled at evading questions. Their ability to not be pinned down on something but to leave vague responses for active interpretation by many people is amazing. Amazing, I'm using that loosely. But depending on who the person is listening to them, you can conclude something totally different than what they're really saying. It makes it very hard because when you're trying to nail them down, you feel like such a jerk, or I do, because you have to keep asking way beyond what you would ask a normal person without feeling like you're just being jerky. I'm not jerky. That's another product. But without being a jerk or being really cruel, I feel like I'm a defense lawyer trying to pin a reluctant witness down on the stand. It's not fun to do. But even then, they will squirm on you. You give them a little tiny hole. They're like a mouse. They can fit their little body through holes all the time. I actually don't know what to do with their sense of morality. It's a question for me and how that fits in. Because, again, some of them, as ministers, pastors, can be the most dogmatic about issues of morality. But in their own personal life, that continues to shift to meet their needs and to get their needs met. And so there's usually this large discrepancy between what they're doing personally and what they preach and what they stand on. Which sometimes is hard when people see that discrepancy. Because that discrepancy isn't always observable to most people. And when that comes to light, it has devastating consequences for a denomination or congregation. Where am I? Number seven, lack empathy and unwilling to identify with the needs of others. This is a big question. Do they really have no empathy, or is it that they're fearful of empathy? One of the other personality disorder that I'm not going to talk about here is, I'm going to bring it in a little bit later, is antisocial personality disorder. And they clearly have no empathy. The one theory is that men who struggle with narcissistic personality disorder do have empathy, but they feel so vulnerable. So here's the theory about what's really behind a narcissist is this fear that they're going to be found out as a fraud, and they're going to be found out that they have no skills or they're not as good as they think. And so the one thought is that the fear is if I'm empathetic to other people, it gives them too much of an ability to hurt me and to use me and to not adore me. And so therefore, to be empathetic is too risky to be expressed. But they struggle to really express any concern for the feelings and hurts of others. That is why a narcissist can be so selfish and cruel to other people and feel like they're doing it for love, for the benefit of those under their care. And they will. They will say things that hurt other people that are closest to them. Their children and their wives particularly are the ones that get the most damage when it comes to that. They don't normally return kindness and interest of other people the way a normal person does. So, for example, the big thing when therapeutic culture swept over America was to make I statements. I really hurt when you do this to me. That is not what you want to talk to a narcissist about. Because they are not going to respond to, I hurt when you do this. You're going to have to be much more cold and calculating, and you're going to have to negotiate like you're in a business deal not expressing your pain because it's unlikely to impact the person you're talking to. We feel better when we say that. It just doesn't have the impact that it would be nice to have. Number eight, they're often envious of others and believe that others are envious of them. They find reasons to be jealous of many people, and they walk around believing that most people are jealous of them, when most people are not, but their sense is that they are. They belittle and diminish the achievements of others in order to elevate their own success, and they compete with other people when other people aren't trying to compete with them because they really need to be the most successful. The last one, they show arrogant, haughty behaviors and attitudes. Again, this is an interesting one, how it plays out in Anabaptist culture, where we don't generally walk around, although some do, just expressing how wonderful you are. So again, they do this mostly in the comments of rude and belittling other people and being excessively false modest about themselves. It's a false modesty that covers up that if you can't be prideful about anything, you certainly can be prideful about your humility. So that becomes one way of expressing that. The other things that are not on this list that I do want to talk a little bit about that are associated frequently with men struggling with narcissism is, number one, this fear of vulnerability. That they do not want to be in a situation where they're vulnerable to the power and control of anybody else. That's my counseling. And walking with people who want to hold them accountable is such a frightening thing for them. Number two, they withdraw and hide from other people who make them feel vulnerable, or they will attack them. Number three is this high level of perfectionism that they often live with and the fear of failure that they have. For some, there is also this hypersensitivity to correction, criticism, rejection, and failure. These men will respond with a great deal of anger and rage whenever they feel that somebody is trying to correct them or criticize them that could lead to rejection. Some of those men don't get into rage, or they do get into rage, and then it quickly becomes depression. They tend to cause distress and difficulty in almost every close relationship they have. Their best relationships are people that they're not as close to, where that admiration and that positive attention is easiest to get. The closer we get to somebody, the less likely people are to see our failures and our flaws, and the less likely they are to see that we're not perfect. And when you need to be perfect, then you need to be adored at all costs. To be with people who know that you're not becomes very frightening. Behind all of this is this sense of fear, of guilt and doubt and inferiority, at least for particular kinds of narcissists. I'm going to talk briefly about the kinds of narcissists that exist, which is going to tie into how we do with them. The first one I'm going to talk about is the covert or vulnerable narcissist. If I had a narcissist in my life that was in my family, I would pray to the Lord that they could be a covert narcissist. A covert narcissist is a narcissist or vulnerable narcissist. I forget if I have this. Do I have this on a slide? I don't think I do. I apologize for that. A covert narcissist is a vulnerable narcissist is somebody that doesn't have the symptoms that we typically associate with narcissism. They're there, but they are very hypersensitive to criticism. They're very insecure and they're very anxious. And so they spend their life running around fearful of rejection and desperately need people's approval. When they have your approval, they will tell you anything. They will talk about anything. They will share anything with you. But as soon as you disagree with them in any way, they will be angry with you and try to cut you out of their life. They withdraw from any social situation or relationship where they don't have constant approval and admiration. They struggle to trust other people. They're always convinced that people are trying to hurt them or cut them down in some ways. In relationships, they continue to nag and complain. They struggle to be able to ever find that their spouse is the woman that they wanted. When you meet them, they will give you the biggest, saddest story you'll ever hear about how their wife is just a beast. She is not worth living with. She is one of the worst women in the world. Recently, I was working with a man who was telling me how awful his wife was, and I said, "Wow, a woman like that, I can't imagine why you'd ever want her in your life." "Oh, but she's my best friend who I love more than anybody else." These men also struggle with authority. They are not fans of ministry and pastors. And they will have conflict with them as long as they can. Well, that's not true. If you adore them, they will treat you with great respect. The thought for these men is that they, underneath, just desperately want to be loved. But don't really have the ability to trust somebody else to do that. And so the rage that they feel is to make up for this feeling, again, this is somewhat like borderline personality disorder, that they are failing at this. The overt or grandiose narcissist does not have that vulnerability. They do not seem to have this fear that they're never going to be loved, which makes it harder to address them or touch their heart. Because they are extremely self-sufficient and they believe in their own superiority for real, it appears. They tend to have shallow relationships. They particularly have disdain for their spouse. They are charming to a fault. I will say this, the more charming these men are, the more damage they can do because they are so skilled in relationships. They can preach the best sermons. They can just make you feel glowing and warm when you walk away from them. They too have an inconsistent moral code, but they hide that code so much better than the covert narcissist. They look, though, the people that can see below the surface really will describe them as arrogant. But they'll divide congregations if they're in leadership because there'll be a bunch of people who say, "Oh, this person is a really arrogant leader." And then you'll have some people who say, "No, he really is such a servant of the Lord." It depends on which side of them you get to see. But there is this arrogance to them that can be hidden to some extent. A high-functioning narcissist is usually an overt narcissist who has particularly skilled at relationships. They are highly skilled at being able to get into relationships and to be socially engaging and be highly successful. They use their narcissism and they use it for its good, and they can become powerfully used by the Lord. This is when the Bible talks about how the parable that Jesus told about the tares and the wheat, and the farmer wants to tear up the tares, and the farmer in the parable says, "Oh, don't tear them up. We'll wait till harvest, because if we tear them up, some of the wheat will be lost, and we can't do that." This is where the Lord sometimes is amazing to me. I'm like, I wouldn't use that person, but the Lord is amazing. His ability to use people who are deeply broken, which is nice because we all are broken, to do his will blows my mind. Because some of those men who I would argue have very little of true love in them can be some of the most powerful for Christ, at least until it blows up. The Lord is amazing in his ability to do that. Malignant narcissists are the narcissists that I'm most fearful of. They're the ones that have the least empathy for other people. They have the most part of antisocial personality disorder or psychopaths, which I'm not going to get into a lot, but they truly do not care for other people. They are callous, manipulative, rule-breaking, exploitative, and shameless. They go through life and act like they're never going to get caught. And oftentimes they don't until later in life. The wounded relationships behind them eventually cause their downfall, but it's often later in life when that happens. The problem again is when their families talk about the abuse that they experience, they are unheard because the person is so charming and so wise. When working with a narcissist, I try to hold this passage in my mind. I hope this is true for them. Romans 7 says this, starting at verse 14. We know what the law is spiritually, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do. What I hate to do, I do. And if I do what I don't want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is no longer I myself who do it, but that it is the sin living within me. For I know that the good itself does not dwell in me, that it is in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I can't carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil that I do not want to do. This I keep doing. Now if I do what I don't want to do, it is no longer I who do it, but the sinful nature or sin living in me. It's true for all of us at some point, you all. But I pray when I run into a man who is a narcissist that this is his internal struggle. That what he's really doing he doesn't want to do, and what he wants to do, he can't do. And that he's aware of that struggle. And he lives with this Romans 7 passage, and that he begins to feel that. The causes of narcissism are much like the causes of BPD, but slightly different. I realize I don't have a slide on this one. There's not a lot of biological underpinnings. The only biological underpinnings that seem to be there is that the part of the brain that's associated with empathy and compassion appears to be smaller than average. So the empathy and compassion part of the brain seems to be smaller than the average person's, along with anger management, which again is fitting when you look at what narcissists struggle with. Some of you may know who Ron Vogt is. Ron Vogt was at Philhaven for many years. Then he left Philhaven. He's done work for years, marriage intensive. I know he's done some. Anabaptists have gone to see him through the years. And Ron specializes in narcissism. And so I will tell you, so there are two pathways to develop narcissism, kind of emotionally or relationally. And the one is you don't receive support as a child. You receive a lot of criticism and rejection from your parents, and you have trauma, very much like what we saw with borderline personality disorders. Men who receive that kind of treatment, that abuse or neglect as a child, tend to become vulnerable narcissists. They tend to be the ones that have that tremendous need for affirmation. On the other hand, you can have parents who overvalidate their children, who give them too much praise, too much validation and support, have no boundaries for them, and treat their children if they're special. And so they begin to treat them as kings from little age up. Ron Vogt argues that you can treat and effectively deal with the one who experiences the abuse and neglect as a child, but you cannot successfully treat those who were treated as kings or queens in their home. was Ron's experience. I don't know what I think about that. I will say that we'll get to some of the things later on, actually right soon here. That is something that you have to consider. The first thing one has to do when you become aware that somebody is a narcissist is make an assessment. This sounds so clinical, and I apologize for those of you who don't do this for a living. Make an assessment about their ability to take ownership into their problems. You have to decide how much do they externalize the problem? How much do they externalize the problem? The more that they externalize the problem, the less vulnerability they're willing to express, the less the more they're willing to lie and twist things, and the more you feel like you're a defense lawyer, you need to be careful because this person is probably unlikely to respond to treatment. And there are some people that you just have to decide. Stealing a line from Dr. Campanella, you have to put fences around them and let them rattle of cages and just don't take the fences down. That feels so un-Christ-like to do. And they will rattle the cages, don't worry. How one makes that decision needs to be taken with wisdom and care and discernment. Steal a line from Joshua Strickler, who I think, Joshua, you said you got this from somebody else. Sometimes we, as men dealing with these men, find it hard to be with them for 1 hour, and we expect their wives to be with them 24 hours a day, 365. And that is true. Sometimes it is very difficult to spend that time with these men. And we expect their wives and their children to be with them all the time. The next step is trying to develop trust. Again, you'll find that I place a lot of attention on development of trust. With a narcissist, you have no chance of being able to speak into their life if they don't trust you and respect you at some level. Or unless you have more force than they do. Trust is difficult to develop with them because they tend to only respect people who are special and have higher positions than the average person. And even then, they give it to you begrudgingly. They are wonderfully skilled at finding your weakness as a leader and exploiting you with it. They will beat you with it like nobody else can. They are amazing at that. But you have to earn their respect in a very different way than you do when you're working with somebody who has borderline personality disorder. In my interactions with men who have narcissistic personality disorder, I become much more forceful and much less agreeable without being rude. That's my goal. Is to be strong without being rude, and which is not my natural style, and so I find that I have to eat my Wheaties on those days and crank that up. I then work to develop a collaborative relationship. That's the wrong quote. Prong point. I develop a collaborative relationship with them where I try to say, I understand why you think that other people are jerks, but that's not going to get you far in work, in life. again, some of you can disagree with me here. You can disagree with me about anything, but you can ultimately really disagree with this one. But I'm going to say, I get why you think everybody else in your life is out to get you and they're jerks, but you know what? That's not going to work very well for you. Let's figure out a way that we can make this work for you, that you can get what you want. I feed into their selfishness and their self-centeredness, which some people find that difficult to do. But I'm going to take that selfishness and that self-centeredness and twist it back on them if I can, to get them to say, you know, what you're doing right now is not getting you what you want. Do we have a chance to get what you want this way? The other thing I work really hard about is, you know, I know that your wife is probably the biggest loser you've ever met, but she's not here. We can't change her. You know, you can pick your wife, you can pick your nose, but if you pick your wife's nose, you will have a mess on your hands and she'll be mad at you. And so we're not going to pick your wife's nose today. We are only going to deal with you who's in front of us because she's not here. So I appreciate how bad your wife is, and I appreciate all those stories, but that's not something we can do. The only thing we can do today is, how are you going to respond to your wife when she does these things that you don't like? Because otherwise, you really do have a mess on your hand, and it's sticky, and you don't want to do anything about it, and it's just not fun, and it's not helpful. The other thing that I do not do well at this, but watch for power struggles and avoid them. They are so good at getting you in a power struggle. Oh, I hate it when I fall for that. And all of a sudden I'm arguing about dumb things, and I think, Chuck, why are you arguing about this? Who cares? But they are so skilled at doing that. But watch for those power struggle traps where you end up arguing about things that don't matter. But they're so skilled at it, because that's much fun for them to argue about those things and be able to beat you with them than things that really matter. Which sometimes means you have to let things fall to the ground that feel very wrong to let fall to the ground. And this gets really tricky when you get into spiritual issues. This is where those of you who are pastors and ministers, the Lord's blessing on you in doing that. Number two, after I develop trust, after I develop trust and I get the ability to speak into their life, again, if I don't get the ability to speak in their life, I'm going to be done working with them because I'm not going to be able to go anywhere. Number three, I do pattern recognition, where we work at looking at how they get to a relationship. Let's go with a husband and wife. You know, I know that you feel like your wife doesn't agree with you. She doesn't respect you. She doesn't honor you. She doesn't submit to you. And so when you feel like she's not doing those things, you then become really, really angry with her, and you swear at her and you call her all kinds of names and you tell her that you're not a Christian. She's not a Christian. Then what happens? Well, she shuts down and she doesn't say anything, or she submits after I do that. Is that the best way to get what you need out of your wife? The worst parts are when they say yes, right? And you will have men who will do that. If, again, that tells you that something else is going on, or you're going to have to use the fence approach, if that's the case, then the next step is to help block those patterns if you can. To help figure out a way for somebody in that person's life or themselves to block that pattern so that they cannot continue to do that. And sometimes you're not going to be able to count on the wife to be able to do that on her own, because she doesn't have the power in the relationship or the personal strength to do that. If they have underlying fears and need for attention, I am going to try to bring them to the surface so that we can talk about their need for approval and love. I'm willing to have that argument and that discussion any day, but it takes my ability to be able to speak into their life to get to that vulnerable area to talk about. And that is really hard to do. Once I get there, then I have a chance to talk about the panic and fear. Again, remember, for the narcissist, they feel out of control, and so their goal is to get you so mad and so hurt and so confused that you can't hurt them. And so that's part of their goal, is to get you in that vulnerable state where you feel like you can't stand up to them. And so their theory seems to be, if I can get you so confused and so vulnerable, you can't do anything to hurt me. I'll address medications here now. The other thing to remember, like borderline personality disorder, there is no medications for narcissistic personality disorder. That doesn't mean that people who are narcissists don't have medications. The antidepressants can take the edge off of the anger and can address the depression. Mood stabilizers, the same ones we talked about with borderline personality disorder, Tegretol, all of those can reduce some of the anger. I have mixed feelings about that one, but I do understand why that's the case. And sometimes antipsychotics are used to control the impulsive behavior. But again, there's no medication that is going to clearly address narcissistic personality disorder. The theory, again, is it's because we're talking about personality. We're talking about the core of who the person is, which is less likely to be affected by medications than other things. Then you try to teach skills. This is actually one of the least favorite things I do in my job. When I grew up on the farm, there was many things I loved about farming, many things I couldn't stand about farming. I hated mechanic work when I was on a farm, and if you can't do mechanic work, you can still farm, but man, it's harder, more expensive, more frustrating. When I'm doing this stuff, it feels like I'm tearing a tractor apart and trying to put it back together, which my brother can do in his sleep, and I can't even do on my best days. Boundary development. Narcissists wouldn't know a boundary. Oh, that's too cruel. Narcissists are not big fans of boundaries. I heard this through somebody I've seen in counseling who I think she heard it from Karen Peachy. Some of you know Karen. Karen uses this analogy where she talks about this circle includes you and what you believe and what you feel. This circle involves what your wife or husband believes, thinks, and feels. Those two circles can actually exist independent one of another, and they don't need to be completely the same. And so therefore, your wife or your husband can have beliefs and emotions that do not completely match yours. You all, that is the most basic emotion, the boundary that you can get. When somebody that you're in a relationship with can actually have beliefs that you don't have, and they don't have to match yours. But I've worked with men who cannot handle their wife having emotions or beliefs that are not in complete alignment with theirs. That makes relationships really tough when your spouse has to believe and feel everything you do. So I start with that boundary, and then we look at boundaries around all sorts of things. When you can argue, when you can't argue. When people should have personal privacy and when they shouldn't. Lots of times, though, you're going to have external boundaries to help the wife in that situation to hold those boundaries. This is where church leadership can be very effective in helping install those boundaries. But it's also brave for church leadership to do that. And it's not easy. I don't want to suggest for those of you who are in the ministry that is an easy thing to do. It certainly wouldn't be what I wake up for one morning and say, oh, today we're going to help set this boundary in the home. I'd rather be fixing a tractor than that. So blessings to you. Number two, I try to get them to be able to accept feedback. Ah, this one is so hard. When your wife has feedback for you, listen to what she's saying. She is not as bad as you think. And if she is, we can work with that. But we have to figure out how you can hear what she's saying. You don't have to agree always, but listen to what she's saying. It comes down to learn to listen to others. Listen to what they're saying and not have to get so caught up in the anger and the need to push back on that. But that fear of being rejected and not being admired becomes so strong that any threat of disagreement or feedback needs to be met with complete force and destruction of the other person. And so therefore, you have to figure out how in the world distress tolerance, I'm jumping all over the place up there, how do I learn to be with my wife or my children, or the ministry, when they are pushing back and they're giving me feedback so that I can contain that rage. Now, if they're really good, especially with the ministry, they're going to be able to contain that rage at least until they get on the vehicle to go home. Right? With their family, they're not going to probably wait that long to do that. But how do we get it so that you can receive feedback without believing? And again, this is what happens to me often in counseling. I get reminded of all the times I've messed up and all the mistakes I made. How dare you try to tell me what I need to change when you clearly aren't where you need to be? You're going to hear that in the ministry too. Any mistake you ever made is going to come out during those conversations. Whatever number that is up there, 3, I think. How do you develop empathy and care for other people? I'm willing to accept for fake empathy. Just pretend. You know, people respond best when you at least pretend to care. Can you pretend? When people are crying, don't tell them that they're a loser or what's wrong with you. All you have to do is just go put your hand on their back and rub it gently or tap, just like this. That's all. If you really want to blow her mind, hug her gently and let her cry. I don't care if you can't stand it at all. Just pretend. She won't know. Which I know feels really bad to say, right? Long time ago, before phones were around, I worked with this guy to develop a spontaneous love calendar that he created for 3 years, where each week on a spontaneous day he did something loving for his wife. His wife called me back about 6 months later. She said, I don't know what you did with my husband, but he is so loving and caring. I was like, not really. He just follows the calendar really well. But man, the spontaneous examples of love expression. Expressing and learning to recognize the feelings of others. Again, this goes back to what I was just talking about. Your wife in front of you is hurting right now. How do you feel her pain, or at least pretend to feel her pain? What about their relationship with God? I don't know. I often wonder what they really think about God. Some clearly have a connection with God and relate to God well. the lying and the shifting the morals are always a difficult for me to know how to put that in the frame of who they are in God. Now, none of us are perfect. We all struggle. So I don't mean to say that. We all fall short of the standards of God. But their willingness to do that, and I often wonder, how do they really experience God? And I don't know that. I don't know how to judge that, and I'm not going to judge that. But again, I've talked about this before, but their ability to be moral pillars in communities so often, despite who they are internally. Again, I'm going to leave that to the Lord to judge, and leave that for the white throne where the judgment takes place. But it is a struggle for me to know what to do with that, and it's hard to push into that evolving morality that they show and how to dress that well. And it's harder for me in some ways than with a borderline young lady, because I at least can get the pain of what in their relationship with God and the feeling that God is not there for them, than that kind of fight that you have with someone who's struggling with narcissism. How do you walk and how do you live with somebody with narcissism? And again, these are overly simple, they just sound so shallow to say, I'm going to say that. Number one, don't overfunction. Don't overfunction. But this is so hard. Living with a narcissist, you learn to do whatever is necessary to avoid the anger and the rage. In tight-knit communities like an Anabaptist culture, you also learn to cover and hide what really happens. For the sake of appearance, for the sake of unity, and for the sake of getting along in the church. After a while, women become overperformers where they carry more and more of the load and have to do more and more of the things around management of the relationship and how it looks. Living with a narcissist can soon make you into a people pleaser, because being a people pleaser becomes easier than experiencing the rage. Number two, in the midst of those emotional outbursts and those personal attacks and those statements about how little you are and how horrible of a person you are, try not to take it personal. But that is really hard when it's the person you're married to who is committed to loving you deeply. Remember, if you can, that this wouldn't be any different if he had married somebody else, even if he tells you his life would have been better if he had married so-and-so. If he had married so-and-so, he would be doing the same thing to her as he is to you. Give yourself permission to not engage in those angry outbursts. I didn't show you number two, did I? Those angry outbursts and those statements. If you get into those conversations, you know that they're not going to go anywhere. It's hard to know exactly how to respond and what to say and what not to say. And how do you just stop having a conversation without completely getting run over? That is the really hard piece. It's not your responsibility to teach your husband how to regulate and control his emotions. You're his wife, not his counselor or not his minister. But again, how do you protect yourself? Again, this seems so shallow and so small. But set the boundaries that you can. Walk away from conversations. Again, it becomes difficult when your spouse doesn't let you, or tracks you down, or forces you into a room to have a conversation. But where you can, seek to find those boundaries, no matter how small it is. This, though, is where you're often going to need the help of other people to help you. I will add this right here. This is where it becomes hard to know who to believe and how to sort through stories. Certainly, there are people who perceive abuse that is not there. There are people who perceive things to be incorrect, but there are actual things that do hurt and that there are abuse. And how, in leadership, do you sort through that and you make sense of that is very difficult. And it takes wisdom and it takes courage and it takes asking and persisting at the same time, but it's not an easy task to do. But yeah, if we can figure out how to do that well, we can help women that are in this situation. Speaking of another term that has exploded on the scene, gaslighting is everywhere. I actually had to Google gaslighting to find out what it was. It's from a movie from the 1940s, you all, right? Isn't it a movie from the 1940s? This is actual, so this is, for those of you who also know, please correct me. Gaslighting was a movie made in the 1940s about a man who, back when there was gas lights, he was determined to convince his wife that she was going blind or was losing her eyesight. So he turned the gas light down a little bit every day on her, and so she kept complaining about the lack of light, and he would project it onto her saying that she can't see, and so he would just keep turning it down. Does that basic gist of it for those of you who know more than I do, what is it? Is that what you would say was the original gaslighting in the movie? I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Gaslighting today, I doubt any of us have seen it, but for somebody that's not seen it, we can talk about it. Gaslighting today is when somebody does what? The same thing. There's so many terms that are out there now. Love bombing, trauma bonding, flying monkeys, all kinds of things. Most of them come from movies, actually, interestingly enough, the terms that are out there. But I'm not going to talk about a lot of them. But gaslighting is when the person uses things and tells you things that begins to believe that you are the crazy one when you're actually not. Sometimes I have women actually write down a journal or notes to remember what they actually said. Because a lot of times when you're working with a narcissist, they can get you to believe you said something that you never believed. This just happened to me recently in a session. I said something at the beginning of the session, and he reminded me at the end of the session that I was actually to blame for what he did in the session because of something I said. And fortunately, his wife was with him, and I said, did I actually say that? I felt bad to say that to her. I hope she didn't pay for that on the way home. But she said, you really didn't say that. That was he was the one that said it. But I forgot if he said it or if I said it. But that can happen so quickly in those cases. I'm going to talk a little bit about the cycle that you often see in these relationships where you have to watch the gaslighting that can take place. George Fox, I believe is his name, has come up with this glorifying, belittling, and abandoning cycle. Glorifying, belittling, and abandoning cycle. Glorifying, some people call love bombing, where the man shows you a great deal of affection and love and care. This is designed to convince you that they really are a good person. I will tell you this. Some of the notes that I have read from narcissistic men about loving kind notes to their wives, man, I wish I could do that. They are some of the most flowery, over the top, amazingly romantic gestures. When they want to turn it on, it is unbelievably effective. Glorifying is when they build you up and they really, really convince you that you are the most important thing to them. Again, other people call that love bombing, where the use of charm and affection. Belittling follows this, where you get insulted, criticized, guilt-tripped, made to feel like you hurt them rather than they hurt you. This can also be a time for threats, both physically and emotionally. This is following. So when the person begins to feel like you're pulling away from them, they beat you to the punch by saying, I'm going to leave you, or I'm going to pull away from you. Because they don't want to be the first one to be hurt. And so they begin to say, I don't really care about you. I don't need you. And nobody's ever going to love you because clearly you're somebody who's unlovable. And so therefore, you're left feeling what? Confused, depressed, and unsure of who you are. Then they have the ability to twist that around and begin to say, you know what? If you demonstrate that you love me, I'll stick around and I'll be here for you. And if you don't watch it, you begin to do that. And then the glorifying happens again, followed by the belittling and abandoning. It becomes a vicious cycle to get into. And it's a difficult cycle to break. And then people talk about trauma bonding, which is where there's a bond that gets formed by living through traumas together, repeated traumas over and over again. And that becomes the cement and the glue that begins to hold that relationship together. I've talked about this before, but I really work hard to get women to learn to negotiate and to treat the relationship as a business arrangement versus a love relationship. Rather, again, to say, you know, I felt hurt tonight when you didn't show up for family devotions and I had to lead it myself, to say things like, hey, we're going to have family devotions at 7 o'clock tonight. If you want to join us, we'd love to have you. But if you're not there, we're going to go on without you. Make it transactional. It's a terrible way to have a relationship, but it's a better than trying to hook those emotions. Lastly, develop a circle of friends and supporters. Oftentimes, when you live with a man with narcissism, they will isolate you from your friends. It's hard for them to trust you talking to other people for fear that you're talking about them, for fear that you're telling stories. They create tension between you and your friends. They drive wedges between you and your friends. Sometimes they just forbid you from meeting with them directly. They may convince you that you're not a good friend and that nobody really would like you, and so why work at it? Find people that you can trust. They're not going to like that at all. They're going to be mad at you for doing it. You're also going to have friends and family members who side with your husband. That's going to be happen because they are convincing. They are able to do that. That's going to be distressing to you, but do remember that's not about you and that your job is not to convince them that somehow you're right and your husband is wrong. That will just be part of the experience. Those friends and support group can help keep you from feeling like you're crazy and that you have somehow lost your way in this relationship. Questions as we close? Yes, Bree.
How does a narcissist or someone with narcissistic personality get to therapy?
Yes. So the question is, how does a narcissist get to therapy? Usually there has to be some kind of crisis in their life, either interpersonally or somehow more publicly that brings them there, some kind of crisis. And they're usually not there willingly on their own. Yes. Ooh. What does a redeemed picture of a narcissist look like? Is that the question? I'm trying to decide how deep I want to go on that question. I wish this. For those of you who know Larry Crabb ended up deep, deep into this picture at the end of his life. I'm going to quote Larry. I wish that redemption happened more quickly and more thoroughly than it actually does in real life. So a redeemed narcissist can use some of those. See, I want to go back to the fact that Nabal was a Calebite. There are pieces of that character, that personality trait, that can be used in a mighty way. But it is so hard to hang in there in that piece. And it takes such, I think, outside accountability as well as an internal commitment to making that change before that can happen. But I think it often that's where the Christian life is best lived in community. When that community can put up those boundaries around that and begin to produce that those external barriers that are needed. That was a terrible answer to your question, but yes. All redeemed narcissists are what? Oh, ouch, you all. So the question, the crux of the question for those of you listening by phone, is the Apostle Paul a redeemed narcissist? Does anyone want to answer that question? I will say this, Paul certainly was a strong personality, wasn't he? For those of you who know the disc, he was probably a clear D. He clearly did not beat around the bush about anything. He would have been better from New York than from central Pennsylvania. Ooh. An excellent question. Can somebody who's a counselor be able to determine a narcissist, or how quickly can you? Can it is very difficult sometimes to determine that without outside of input. They are really good, and so it is not a guarantee that you can send somebody to a professional and they will come back and say that was a narcissist. Wow, so many hands right back there. Then Sam, and then over here. Yes. Oh, so the question is, do I think that there are more narcissists in ministry than not? I don't necessarily. I do thank you for clarifying that. I did speak about that, but I do want to say I don't think it's more likely to be there. Yeah, we could ask questions about the lot and all of that too, and how that fits into those for groups that use the lot. Sam. Yeah, so the question is, why has narcissism so exploded, and what kind of factors attribute to the rise of narcissism? So one of the cultural differences that I wanted to talk about that I didn't, so thank you for bringing this back to this. In the country, broadly, and so this is where I begin to wonder, and it's probably true. So if you live in an individualistic culture where the individual is championed above everything, and that person gets to determine everything, including your identity, sexual identity, all kinds of other things, narcissism rises in that country. So the typical 22-year-old, I forget the exact date, young person today has the narcissistic score on measures of narcissism that somebody that got diagnosed with narcissism did in the 1960s. So as a culture, we are clearly more narcissistic. I thought Anabaptist culture would be more immune to it than it seems to be. So one of the things I think that has happened is that narcissistic, individualistic approach from outside has seeped into Anabaptist culture, and that is one of the factors. That's not the only factor, I think. I also think there's just more people, there's more discussion about poor marriages and things that would have not been addressed before get addressed now. I think both of those factors play a role. Somebody up here. Was it one of you? Yeah, right there. I mean, it may make them uncomfortable, but I would say you need that structure for yourself and for them. But they're not going to like it, and they're going to get you any bunny trail you can for needless arguments. But I do think that accountability is helpful, because yes, otherwise, isn't it crazy? You get done with a meeting, you think that was never close where we were supposed to go. One last question. I try to work really hard to say that I to portray, I don't actually say it very often, that I will tolerate your anxiety and your anger without pushing you away, but I never make the promise that I will not hurt you, because I'm sure that I will disappoint you and hurt you in that way. But try to be willing to tolerate that anxiety and that anger and absorb a lot of that without feeling abused. But I will often say, I am sure that I'm going to disappoint you and hurt you. I try to make that a big point, because I will. I will do that. And so I try to set that up as an expectation that I will hurt and disappoint.